Hi, I'm Piper.
And I'm Erin.
Welcome to Off the Tracks Podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently.
Today we are joined by Amy Matuszek. Amy is the founder and principal lawyer at Prison and Police Law, a law practice dedicated to advocacy on behalf of those experiencing mistreatment while detained or imprisoned. She previously clerked at the Provincial Court of Alberta and the Nunavut Court of Justice. In her spare time, Amy enjoys powerlifting. We are so excited to have her.
Amy, thank you so much for joining us today. We are so thrilled you're here. I have just heard the best things about you through all of my colleagues at U of C. And so having you here is just such a treat. And obviously, like, I know you went to U of C law, but how has your career evolved over time? How did prison and police law, you know, there were so many steps before that. So we'd love to hear a little bit about how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really flattered that you're hearing good things at the University of Calgary and a little concerned, to be honest, that like these people don't know what they're talking about. So I graduated from U Calgary in 2018 and then articled for 10 months to the Provincial Court of Alberta in Calgary, which was great just because clerking for a trial level court is not what I think clerking is necessarily associated with in terms of like the heavy academic work or it being really theoretical. Like I got to assist with a lot of like very on the ground projects related to like how vulnerable people encounter the justice system at first instance. So I did that for 10 months. Then I completed my articles at the Public Interest Law Clinic at the University of Calgary, which was lovely of them because by the time I started at the Public Interest Law Clinic, I'd already accepted a second clerkship at the Nunavut Court of Justice. And for various complicated reasons, it turned out that I couldn't just clerk twice in two different jurisdictions because I would be partially eligible to be called to the bar in both, but fully eligible in neither. So I like quickly finished my 5 months of articling in Alberta and then like got called to the bar on September 4th and left for Nunavut on September 5th. And that was 2019. So then after that, I clerked in Nunavut for 20 months and then came back and started prison and police law, which seems a bit abrupt, but it made sense in the context because I knew I was coming back to Alberta and I knew I didn't want to do any of the types of law that are usually associated with Alberta. So like corporate business, energy, stuff like that. And I also knew that a big firm structure wasn't going to work for me just in terms of work-life balance. And as a very high anxiety person who I don't think would respond well to things like billable hour targets and lots of things that are inherent in law firm culture. Like, for example, having to wear hard pants all the time was a live concern for me.
So, I don't understand people that like hard pants. Like nobody likes hard pants.
No, I joke that I should bill clients more for days where I have to wear hard pants on their behalf.
Okay. And what qualifies as a hard pant? I've never heard this term before, but I think I can get behind it very quickly.
Yeah. Okay. So anything, we're talking like anything with a polyester lining.
Okay.
Anything that is not stretchy.
Okay. Oh. Yeah. Okay, so like a hard pant. But like, does denim count as a hard pant? Is denim a hard pant?
I think denim is a hard pant, to be honest.
Like, I guess it depends on if it's like the stretchy legging-ish kind or if it's like real denim.
Listen, like I'm from Calgary, so if we're talking like Stampede level denim, that is absolutely a hard pant. And I you will not catch me wearing that to the office.
I would like to qualify, I don't mind a hard pant for standing up only. Like sometimes if I'm going to like a, you know, an event or reception, if I know I'm just going to be standing, I can do a hard pant.
Yeah. But
those events are few and far between.
Indeed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No.
Okay. Love this. I love this new term. Going to incorporate it. Yes. Here for it. Okay. So we are dying to know a bit more about your experience as a judicial law clerk at the Nunavut Court of Justice. And if I can do math properly, that would mean that you were there during COVID. Is that correct? So that would be really interesting to sort of hear a bit about what your experiences were like being there during this sort of life-altering time.
Yeah, it actually, I think that I had a comparatively really good, is like a weird term to use, but in comparison to everyone else, I moved to Nunavut in September 2019. So I had about 6 months of like normal-ish life before COVID hit. And what that involved in those 6 months is that the Nunavut Court of Justice got like ransomware hacked, which I guess is a thing that can happen in smaller jurisdictions where they know that your court, like your the documents aren't stored like in a maximally secure way that they would be in a bigger jurisdiction. So they'll hack you. Then they'll say, we won't release all this data back to you unless you pay us. So that was like a whole month's worth of drama that happened. Couldn't use our work computers.
This happened in an episode of my favorite television show to ever exist, The Good Wife. Yes, this happened in The Good Wife and it seemed very dramatic. So I'm sorry that you and the system had to go through that.
Yes, it was very dramatic. But I mean, I feel sort of sad that I didn't get to just continue living life like those 6 months were, because it was very like experiencing tons of new things. The whole reason that I wanted to clerk in Nunavut was because I have always been really interested in Indigenous rights, but only from like an extremely theoretical perspective. I knew that I did not have like an iota of lived experience of like what it's actually like to experience the colonial justice system from the perspective of someone who lives in an Indigenous community. And Nunavut is such an interesting example of that, because it's the first, it's the only jurisdiction in Canada that exists as a result of a land claims agreement. And it is owned by Inuit, and the government of Nunavut is, what's the term? Sorry, I'm blanking the term for when it's not democratic. It's like consensus decision making. Yeah. So the opportunity to experience all of that, and also to experience being in a place where you just, the thing that people do on weekends is go out on the tundra on their skidoos, or they go fishing, or was really cool. I got there just in time for berry picking season, and so everyone was spending like tons and tons of their spare time just like berry picking, because they're only out for like a month. So that was amazing. And I learned a lot about what it's like to be in a like a young jurisdiction, I'm using air quotes, in that Nunavut's only had its own case law and legislation for the last 20 years. So a lot of the novel legal issues that arise are just like pure statutory interpretation questions. So all of that was great. And then COVID happened, and Nunavut as a territory is about 40,000 people, but they have about 5, maybe 7 ventilators. There's one hospital in Iqaluit, which is the capital. So they took it super seriously and completely locked down right away. You couldn't get into the territory unless you were a resident. And even if you were a resident, you had to quarantine for 2 weeks in a hotel in Ottawa before flying up. So they took it really seriously, probably for like March, April, May. And then in June, it became clear that their measures were effective at preventing cases, because there hadn't been a single case of COVID in Nunavut for those 4 months. So they eased up for the summer, and we had a pretty normal summer 2020. Like I played on a softball team, and like I had an indoor birthday party, and a bunch of normal stuff happened. And that extended into the fall, into about November 2020, when we actually did have cases. And then everyone went into lockdown for about a month. And then we were back in the office for a little bit before going back home again due to another surge. And then my contract was over in end of May 2021. It was a roller coaster, but comparatively, you know, everyone else in the rest of Canada was pretty much like working from home for that entire time. And I got to be in the office, and I got to hang out with people in like relatively normal ways and do things like go to Nunavut's single brewery on the weekends. So I was really lucky.
That's amazing, Amy. And it's just so interesting to start to really like, obviously you had clerked at the provincial court in Alberta, but to really like launch your legal career in such a niche and isolated space, isolated in so many senses, like from the legal profession, from the rest of Canada. Like we haven't even gotten into the cost of living, I'm sure, up north. I have so many questions. I'm not sure if they're like right for the podcast right now, but that's just so, so fascinating. I'm sure that that's like a lifetime of experience. So you said to us previously that you're still a member of the Nunavut Bar, correct? And so How do you utilize that in your practice, if at all?
I take contracts from Nunavut Legal Aid for the same issues that I work on in Alberta. So police misconduct and prison injustice. I think I have like probably one or two of those ongoing right now. And I have to travel up to Nunavut sometime in 2023, actually, because they have this rule that you have to do your, like your bar call oath in person. So it's a great excuse to go back. I also went back in April 2022 and I did a 12-day ski camping trip between two communities. Like one is just above the Arctic Circle and one is just below the Arctic Circle. So we like cross-country skied and camped.
Wow, that is so cool. Yeah. That is gotta be one of like the coolest vacation trips I've heard of. That is incredible. Yeah, that sounds amazing. And so definitely worth it to, I mean, of all the in-person bar call to the bars, I feel like that's the coolest one to have to go to.
Yes. And I have been to, like, this will not feature at my bar call, but I've been to some super cool bar calls for Inuit or Inuk new members, where they have their kids like do throat singing at their bar call, which is,
oh, wow,
super unique.
That's amazing. Well, I'm so excited for you. That is going to be such an exciting trip. But we would love to know a bit more about how you decided to niche down into prison and police law, and especially so early in your legal career. And if you have any advice for others who want to niche down, and especially early, and this comes kind of selfishly too, because I said I wanted to niche down early and it took me like 2 years of practicing to actually even sort of niche down. And I know I could even niche down further. So I really admire the work that you do and would love to know a bit more about how you were able to make that leap.
Yeah, I mean, it comes as sort of a combination of knowing I was moving back to Alberta and I would need to figure out a way to practice law that worked for me that wasn't in a traditional firm setting. And then also having a background from law school of doing a bunch of research into habeas corpus, which is, for people who don't know that much about habeas corpus, it's a particular charter remedy you can get when the state has unlawfully detained you. So I had that background going into prison law, and I knew from talking to other lawyers that there's no one else in Alberta who practices prison-related issues as their main niche. So it seemed like a good fit because it was a background that I already had, and this was in the wake of George Floyd and police misconduct was becoming a much greater thing, and I don't know where this idea came from, but I was like, I don't think there's anyone who practices in police misconduct, or at least not anyone that I know of. So it was sort of aspirational. Like I just put it out there. I was like, I'm doing prison justice and police misconduct. And I guess I'm going to have to figure out what that means as I go along. But like, to answer your question about niching down, like it's kind of a tough one because I don't think that I was ever particularly afraid of that. I think that I was more afraid of doing something very general that I didn't care about and then feeling stuck. But I also think that I practice in an area where it's very easy to have a niche because I picked something on purpose that no one else around me does. So I made it easy for myself to focus on those particular things. Easy being a relative term here. There are reasons that no one focuses on those things, and it's because they're hard and also people can't usually pay you. But I don't know if that really answers the question because I don't think I really have advice for people.
I guess a question I have sort of building off of that is, and I mean, I just have so many questions for you, but
we can talk.
We'll talk. Something building off of that is like, how do I phrase this? Like, if you're the only person that really practices in this niche, how, if at all, have you been able to seek mentorship outside of your amazing clerkship experiences?
Oh, with difficulty. Like, that's like an ongoing, like, probably like one of the things that is most stressful for me about practicing is that I feel like I'm constantly running into things that I don't totally know how to do, and I'm not sure where to access mentorship for them. And the reason this is stressful is because when I don't know how to do something, I just take a stab at it. And the people who are most likely to inform me that I did it wrong are opposing counsel and not always super nicely. So I find that really stressful, especially because I'm also constantly worried that I am doing clients a disservice as well, by not feeling as competent as I probably could. So I don't know, like I'm using a combination of Twitter, honestly. I do a lot of just like tweeting. Do I know any lawyers in Manitoba who've done X recently? And just like kind of hoping that the internet will deliver. And then using Law Society resources like Advisor Link in Alberta. And oh God, like the number of times I've called the practice advisors, like being panicked has been a lot. But I also kind of feel like I should just like walk around with a flashing sign that's like needs mentorship. Like older civil practice lawyer, preferably female, please have like cool political beliefs and then just like take my phone calls like 5 times a week, you know?
Like 1,000,000%. I think that finding mentorship early in your career, especially if you're not working in big law, can be really challenging. And I've spoken to so many people about this. And even recently I was having a conversation with someone this week. And I know it's something that I like have really like in previous, like when I was practicing, like was like, oh my gosh, like why, where do I find this mentorship that everyone speaks of? And now like in my non-practicing role, I have a different kind of mentorship and that's great. But I think that like having those good mentors is so important. And I think so is the idea of like paying it forward. So like right now we're all talking about like, we need mentorship. We want mentorship. And I know that like speaking with you and speaking with Aaron, like I know that you both are the people who will pay it forward. And I know you're already paying it forward in so many ways. So it's just so important. If anyone's listening and wants to mentor Amy, please reach out. And if anyone is ever listening to the podcast and is like, hey, that person was cool, like maybe they'll mentor me, reach out to Aaron and I, or I, and we'll make an introduction, because like, I think that all of this goodness like needs to go around. And yeah, anyways. Okay. Amy, moving in another direction for a second, you spoke briefly about like, you know, another thing that's difficult is that your clients aren't typically in a position to pay you. So how do you create boundaries when you're consistently working with vulnerable populations?
I guess that's kind of two questions. Like one question is about getting paid and one question is about like boundaries with vulnerable populations. And I feel like those are different things. So I think that I'll talk about the getting paid thing first. And the answer is like a combination of a lot of different things, because there's no one approach that I find works for people the best. I do have some hourly clients, not a lot, but I have like maybe 3 that I bill hourly, because that works for them and that's what they're used to. And it's nice for me because it makes me more money. And then the rest of them are a combination of a bunch of things. I do some contingency files. So where someone has been injured and they can't afford to pay me, but they have a good claim and it's likely to settle, then I'll take it on contingency. But something that I'm doing now, as a result of kind of muddling along on contingency files and realizing at the beginning that I didn't have the tools yet to figure out what was a good claim that was likely to settle, is that I don't agree to take people on contingency right away. I say, listen, I will collect all of your records and do like a legal opinion letter about the things you might be able to do to address what happened to you. And that's just a flat fee of $1,000. Like, pay me that. I will tell you, these are the things you can do to address what happened to you. This is what it would cost to have me do them. And if I think your claim is really good, I'll tell you whether I would agree to take it on contingency. So that has the advantage that clients walk away with something that is like actually useful information for them. So if they decide not to pursue a civil remedy, they know they can go to maybe victims of crime. They know they can go to the Alberta or the Canadian Human Rights Commission. They know stuff like that. And then also it creates some cash flow for me up front without putting a really untenable financial burden on people, because lots of people can afford $1,000. And even if they can't afford $1,000, I charge $100 for initial consults, which is doable for almost everyone. The downside to that is that I do say to people, it costs $1,000. I can't afford to do it pro bono. And they say, okay, I guess I can't afford it right now, and walk away. And that, oh, I should also mention while I'm on this topic that I do parole hearings and detention hearings and appeals of parole decisions, and I charge flat rates for those as well. So that helps with getting paid, that I charge relatively low flat rates for those things. And so far it's worked out that a balance of charging low flat rates for discrete issues like that. So like this sort of records review thing and the parole thing creates enough cash flow that I can kind of wait for some of the contingency things to resolve and then get a lump sum that helps keep me going for a bit longer. But then on the vulnerable clients question, I have found that obviously it's not possible for me to help someone with every possible problem that they have. And it does no one any favors for me to pretend that I can. So I found that the best thing to do right up front is to be very clear with people about what their lawyer can and cannot do. And I have a really frank conversation with a lot of people right at the beginning of our relationship that if you're looking for justice, honestly, the civil legal system's not a great place to find it. You are not likely to emerge from the civil legal system feeling like, I got justice and I got justice in the way that I wanted and I feel the way that I wanted to coming out of this. So when people come to me and they say, I just want justice, I often say, look, you will not find it in the civil legal system. You might find some money, but you won't feel good. So you should think about that. And I think like every lawyer, not all of my client relationships end up going super well in the long term. And sometimes people do things like call me and, you know, leave abusive voicemails repeatedly as I ask them not to, or things like that. And in those situations, I just have to end the relationship because putting up with behavior that like that, it doesn't really help the client and it's pretty psychologically difficult for me. So it's this really ongoing balance of figuring out what do I need to be a person who has the mental resources to keep doing this job? And how do I balance that with what I'm able to give other people and constantly hitting a balance somewhere in there where I'm honest with people about what I can give them and I'm honest about the standard of behavior that I expect. And I know how to stand up for myself and say, I know you're in a tough situation, but it's not appropriate to speak to your lawyer that way.
Yeah, I think that's probably like a very hard thing to do too, because you're dealing with a lot of people who are in really rough situations and have experienced really awful things. And I find that challenging too. And so sometimes I am bad with letting that kind of roll a little too much sometimes, because I'm like, oh, I feel for them that, you know, they're in detention, they just got here, they just fled from like a war or whatever they're fleeing. And it's really easy to sort of start making excuses for that sort of behavior. But I think it's really important that you have those frank conversations, like you said. And honestly, prior to this, Amy talked to me a bit about practice management and really helped me talk through some boundaries as well. And one thing that I love that you do is that you're very strict with your time and the like time period that you will give to clients. And so I really enjoy that you set time blocks out for this is when you can contact me. This is when you can expect a solid answer from me. And then the other time I'm going to be doing work on your file that you may or may not see, and you may or may not hear from me, but you can expect to talk to me during these things. And I think you call them like office hours, where you like have your clients be able to call in and talk to you just through these like set periods of time. And so I am actively trying to work on this, but I just think it's so brilliant because, you know, it helps sort of put those boundaries in place and sort of helps you navigate your relationship with clients, even when they're in really, really shitty situations.
Well, yeah. And I think it's important to recognize too, lawyers have a responsibility here when it comes to communicating with people in a way that's accessible. And I play a role in communicating information to people in a way that makes sense to them, because sometimes lawyers can, when they're struggling to translate a complicated legal concept into plain language, they can default to this position of like, oh, trust me, I'm a lawyer. And that's just not accessible for a client. They have no reason to trust you. Like you're saying, lots of times they're coming from situations where institutions have failed them over and over and over again, and they have zero lived experience that suggests to them that I'm a trustworthy person. So lawyers also bear some responsibility for communicating with clients in a way that actually gives them the information they need while protecting your boundaries as a lawyer and recognizing that you are a limited person. And if someone comes to you last thing on a Friday with a question, you will not have it for them first thing on a Monday.
Yeah. So kind of tying into that, how do you take care of your mental health, especially working in this field? How do you sort of balance those things?
I have a really good therapist who I see a lot. And this is an ongoing area where I know that I can improve, but I, you know, take anxiety medication and I get as much exercise as possible. And I try to have the ability to back off from an intense feeling and do some self-talk that I've learned from my therapist. Like, X feels really overwhelming right now, and it feels like it's always going to feel that way, but it's not. So give it 24 hours and come back to it. Nothing's going to explode. Nothing's going to change if you take 24 hours to think about something. And I kind of think like an underrated strategy for dealing with the stress that comes with this profession is not forcing yourself to come up with a solution right away, taking some time to just like let it sit in the back of your brain and like work itself out, taking some time to think like, who could I ask about this? Can I ask the internet? Can I ask another lawyer? Who can I reach out to who will not only give me some background that I need, but who will also provide some validation and say, this is complicated and hard. Let me help you. This has been one of the biggest challenges for me, is that it's so hard to ask for help in a profession like this, where you can often feel like you're not doing your job if you ever admit that you don't know anything or if you ever look stupid. And the biggest thing that I continue to struggle with is feeling like I look dumb. And I think that the biggest thing that I need to do to continue to do this role in a way that works for my mental health is just accept that everyone looks dumb sometimes.
Oh, Amy, I feel all this. And I've said on previous episodes before, like, something I've learned is that nobody has everything all figured out. And that's something that like I personally have been really dealing with also lately, is just being like, I always feel like I'm failing at something. Like, I feel like there's so many balls in the air and at least one, if not two, are always getting dropped in such a big way, like dropped and shattering. Like, they're not bouncing back up. They're like shattering. It's not even like a matter of how do I keep it all together right now. It's like, how do I keep as many balls somewhat in there? Like, not high, but just like hovering so they're not shattering.
Yeah. And how do I make it so that as little of that as possible comes down to the fact that I rely on myself to remember something, or the fact that I rely on myself to know something at some point in the future that I don't know now. And so I think that kind of comes back to what Erin was saying about needing to block off your time. Like, I have time blocks in a week, like Monday morning and Tuesday morning for 3 hours. I do scheduled phone calls. Wednesday afternoon for 3 hours, I go through every single file that I have for like 30 seconds each and make a note of like, so what happened a week ago on this? Did I email someone that I need to follow up with? Did I tell the client I would get them something by a certain time? If I did, have I created a task for myself that later me will see and remember that says, Amy said that she would get X person Y thing by Z time? And then, like you were saying, I do like unscheduled calls on Thursday mornings, and all other time is like, I'm not here. You can't speak to me. And that's the only way that I figure out how to do it, because there's just so few hours in the work week.
I love it. Oh my God. Okay. I'm like taking mental notes right now. I love that file review idea. And also, just to double back on the feeling dumb, I literally right before this call called one of my mentors. I was like, am I stupid? I am reading this website. Please tell me that I am reading the same thing that you are reading, because IRCC sent me back a note on one of my files and was like, you need this form. And I'm like, but I'm looking at their website and it says I don't need the form. So like, am I stupid or is the world stupid? Because I honestly don't know.
Literally, I have two emails sitting in my inbox right now from opposing counsel. They've been there since like Monday or Tuesday, and I just don't have the mental capacity to open them yet. Nothing is time sensitive. I just know that they contain information about mistakes that I've made, and I'm not there. I can't do it right now.
I also really believe, and I was speaking about this with a colleague yesterday, how like there's just this urgency in the world. And granted, like there, yes, in law and like what's filing deadlines and things, there are urgent things often, but there are also things that are not urgent that people like to pretend are urgent. Ooh. And I definitely am really trying to move away from that. This past week, I got in my business, not in my full-time job, in my business, I got 3 emails from one person. And I just thought none of these were urgent. And my response time is not 5 hours. It's 24 or 48 hours. That's a bit of a stretch recently, but like, I definitely aim for 48 hours. It has been really hard as of late. But yeah, I just really, I wish that we could move the world away from this, mm-hmm. this idea that everything is urgent, because it's yes. not.
And also, you know, learn to validate for other people, especially like clients who are in crisis. Like, I know that X thing feels urgent for you, and I will get back to you by a date in the future that is reasonable that I can actually meet. Like, something that I've learned is like, don't tell people that you'll get back to them by an unreasonable date that you can't. Like, often I will say like, okay, thank you for this. I will get back to you by the end of the month. And like, it's a full month later. Like, I know that I can make that, and it creates a reasonable expectation that usually I can exceed. And that, like, I kind of think that helps keep everyone happier, like makes me happier. Then I like get the thing back early, which makes the client happier. But
oh, this is another Amy just dropping facts. Like, I need to learn this one too, because I am notorious for saying, oh, I'll get, like, I just am very stressed in the moment. And I'm like, yeah, I'll get back to you tomorrow. And I just say it. And I'm like, there's no way. Like, do you see your own schedule tomorrow? Like, you are just as stressed tomorrow as you. And then you just play ping pong. And you're like, oh, actually, I didn't get a chance to do it today. Again, sorry, I will get back to you tomorrow. And then it's just like a week of that. Oh my gosh.
This episode should be called a masterclass in boundaries with Amy.
Oh God, not even though. Like, something that I've started doing too is I take a lot of phone calls from clients who are in prison, and I don't really know the next time that I'll get to talk to them, because I use some combo of like connecting with a family member who tells the family member tells the person in prison when to call me. That's one thing. Then with some prisons, they'll let me pre-schedule a call. So I do that with some people. And with some people, like, there are a few prisons where I have a client in there who has no family members that I can reach on the outside, and the institution will never schedule a call with me, where literally I rely on them calling me and leaving voicemails and them calling me during office hours. So when I'm on the phone with clients like that, I've started doing something where I say, okay, I just want to make sure that we both know the plan going forward. You're going to do X, Y, and Z. Before we talk next, I'm going to do A, B, and C. The next time we talk, how should I get in touch with you? Do you want to contact me? And I think that in a perfect world, I would also send them a letter that would say that I did that, but there are only so many hours in the day. So working on it.
Definitely. Oh my goodness. Amy, thank you for all of this. We're going to pivot slightly. And I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about how you see like your life and your practice evolving over the next few years. I know that this is something that we were really curious about talking to you about, and how you kind of see, you know, life and your practice changing as time goes on.
Ooh, it's kind of a scary question. I've been thinking about this recently because this is the first time that I've done anything for a long period of time. You know, you like do an undergrad and then you take a year off, then you do law school, and then you clerk again. And now I'm doing this thing that I've been doing for like a year and a half. And it's pretty scary to think like I'm 31, and if I retire when I'm 65, I'm going to do like basically this for 34 more years. Like, what? So I don't really know. And I think honestly, part of managing my mental health recently has been that I can't think too far down that road, because there are so many questions that I don't know the answers to that come up in my day-to-day practice, that just in order to take care of myself, I need to be able to say, okay, you just need to find the answer to this thing that is in front of you right now. You don't need to know, how am I going to manage this file 4 steps down the line? I just need to know, do I have a precedent for X document? Do I know the legal tests for whatever that I need to draft in this document? Do I know what the deadline is for it? And like, do I have a plan to meet the deadline? Like, just for the sake of my own mental health, I can't think too far down the road on even individual files. And the same is kind of true for my life right now, which is that I think if I try to plan too far in advance, it's going to be stressful as opposed to helpful. And another thing that is kind of inherent in this stage of life is that I'm doing a bunch of other life things. Like I got married a year and a half ago. I am thinking about starting a family in the next 5 years, maybe. I'm currently trying to buy a house with my husband. And so much of how the future looks will depend on those things. So I'm trying to kind of hold those two things in tension with each other and both acknowledge that it might not be possible to come up with a plan right now, and also give myself enough stability and predictability to everyday life that I don't like explode.
Yeah, this is also, I mean, a huge thing that crosses my mind too. I'm notorious for getting 5,000 steps ahead of myself. So I'm not even married yet. I'm getting married in the summer. And as Piper knows, I go like 5,000 steps down the road. So I'm already thinking about this too. And I think just being in this age group as woman, unfortunately, it's like every time you go to the doctor, it's a question that, what are your plans? Yeah, exactly. So, and then being self-employed too, it's just a whole other, you know,
Something that's important to recognize that I want to say just right off the top, and that I try to say in conversations with anyone who's behind me in this process, is that being self-employed is hard, but it's also something that often you get to do because of some amount of privilege going into it. And so I try to acknowledge for people, like, I live in a house without a mortgage because my husband inherited it from his mom. I don't have any student loans because I moved to the Arctic after law school, where the pay is very high and I just paid them all off. I don't have any debilitating health conditions and I don't have any dependents who do. I don't have any kids. My husband does like 90% of the cooking and cleaning in our house. So I just think that that's related to what you were saying, in that being self-employed is hard, and it's especially hard when you're looking at trying to do things like motherhood. But I also think that there's a sense in which people, especially like young women, especially young lawyers, look out there and think people must be doing important things like this because they're smarter or better or somehow more educated than me. And it's actually just not true. Like, some of us have a lot of resources, and a lot of us need to be better at just acknowledging I'm doing this because I have like a lot of support, not because I'm better than you.
Amy, I want to cry. That was so wonderful. And I am so grateful you talked about that. I think that that's so true. And I think some like social media and like the ways in which we present ourselves online and in person are never like a full representation of who we are, what we have, what our, you know, background is. And it's funny, I just got this game. It's called Where Should We Begin? And it's by a therapist called Esther Prill. Yeah. And one of the cards, I've been playing with a friend, and one of the cards said, what is something you've been faking recently? And I, And I said to my friend, I said like, one second, like I'm going to have to think about it. And I was like trying to think of something that I've been faking. I think I might've talked about like maybe faking, like having it all together. I was like, you know, since I moved to Calgary, my house is messier than it's ever been. I'm a really like clean and tidy person. And since I've moved to Calgary, that's just one of the balls that's like really shattered kind of thing. And this person said to me, well, that's not what you've been faking. You've been faking this. And they dropped this huge bomb on me of something I've been faking.
Oh my God. I hope this person's a good friend.
And I thought, okay, yeah, that's true. I have been faking that. That's very astute.
Also, anyway, goodbye. Please leave my house now while I cry.
So I guess my point is I just appreciate like your transparency. And I really think like that's really what we try to do on the podcast, is like be really transparent and have guests on who talk about these things and, you know, talk about like their positioning and where they're coming from in all senses. So we're so, so, so grateful you've joined us today and you've shared all this with us. We always like to end the podcast with the same question, which is, what is something, anything new that you've learned recently?
Oh man, I have a life hack for you. Okay. So as a person who's into scented candles, I spend $45 once a week on like the bougiest scented candle that I can possibly get. Do you guys know Milk Jar? It's like,
I literally was about to say, are you going to say Milk Jar? And no. I went over the winter holidays, a friend of mine was visiting me and we went to a Milk Jar candle making workshop. Have you ever been to one? Okay. Well, Amy, we'll talk. We'll go to one together. It's so great.
Okay. So anyway, it turns out that if you know those little things that plug into a USB port that you can get that will like keep your mug of coffee warm, turns out you can just get one of those. You can put your bougie scented candle on it, not light it. It still smells great, but it lasts like a bajillion times longer. So like, that's my life hack for you. You're welcome.
Wow. That's kind of like a DIY, you know, those like fancy ones that are like the candle warmers. Have you seen those on TikTok? Love this. I love this idea.
Jaw on the floor.
And then no smoke too, right?
No smoke. Much safer if like me, you're prone to just walking away from your candle.
Yeah. I was going to sit
on the couch.
Yeah.
I recently left the house with the oven on. Yeah. For 2 hours.
Balls in the air. You know, let's just do our favor and just like remove the ball from the air entirely. This is my intention for 2023 is let's just like get rid of that. Take it out.
I love it.
Oh my gosh. Wow. This episode was exactly what my soul needed. Thank you so much for recording with us and for spending time with us today and sharing all of your stories and experiences. We are so, so, so grateful you chose to have this conversation with us. Thank you so much for being here.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode. To stay up to date with the podcast, follow us on Instagram at Off the Tracks Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite listening platform for a brand new episode of Off the Tracks Podcast every Tuesday.